This is the podcast for Physics 2710, Modern Physics. The date is 17th of January, 2007. Welcome, everyone. I guess we can all be seen, see or be seen. We're seeing ourselves right now. What I'd like to do today is see how much of Chapter 2 we can finish up. And if you have lots of questions, that's fine. We have a little bit of luxury in my kind of mental planning that if we need an extra hour or something someday, we can squeeze it in. But generally about a chapter a week, and this is the second week, and this is the second chapter. For the hour and a half of today's class, I'd like to kind of continue what we were doing last time, although I'd like you to feel free to butt in and ask questions. I have the remote here, and we can stop stuff when we need to and ask the appropriate questions and discuss stuff and point things out in the book. But I'm still a big fan of these videos, and I hope that you're enjoying them too. And I sent you the URL so you can watch them again or later or whatever if you want to. I did notice that you were right about my webpage for this class. They moved everything over to a new server and forgot to copy over the folder for this class. And so that's been taken care of, and it should work. Should be there. In fact, I tested it before class.
Yeah,
okay. Let's switch back to the video, and we'll play. By the way, what's ironic is this was made just before, I mean, back when the Brooklyn Dodgers were in Brooklyn. They don't play there anymore. It's haven't for 20 years. What would this look like from the perspective of the observers in the lab, these experimenters? How would they explain this? And I guess the corollary question is, how would the muons explain this? They're in a different reference frame. When we talk about time dilation, we would say the muons have these internal clocks that make them decay. It's a statistical random process. We don't know when any particular muon is going to decay, but we know statistics and averages, and there's lots of them. So we know on average that they live for 2 millionths of a second. And if they're moving really, really, really fast, those internal clocks would run slow. So they would last for much longer than 2 millionths of a second. So they have a lot of them at the top of the mountain. They also have a lot of them at the bottom of the mountain, even though you would calculate they wouldn't, because they're moving so fast that their clocks are slow, and those 2 millionths of a second, you know, let them go a long ways in that time. That would be the explanation from the laboratory reference frame. How would the muons explain this? Their clocks aren't going slow to them. Their clocks are just ticking by at the normal rate. So is there a contradiction here or a paradox? Who'd like to take a stab at this? Okay, that's true as far as it goes. Each of the two reference frames sees the other reference frame's clocks as going slow. So you're right about that, but I'm not quite sure that explains how they can survive the trip down from the top of the mountain to the bottom without decaying. Yes, they would say our clock is slow, but still, they travel all that distance anyway. We can explain it because we say their clocks are going slow, but I don't think that explanation works for them in that reference frame. So what other thing can they invoke?
Well, what I would wonder is if to them, since they're looking at the Earth and that's in a different reference frame, the distance from to them is shorter.
That's right. We invoke time dilation. They invoke length contraction. The muons would say they're in a reference frame which they are perfectly entitled to call at rest, and the Earth is rushing up to meet it. And the Earth is moving at them with a speed that's very close to the speed of light. So things in the moving reference frame, the Earth, appear foreshortened by a great deal. And so the atmosphere appears very thin. So in their normal clock time, they only have 2 millionths of a second, they can make it through the atmosphere because it's not really hundreds of miles thick. It's foreshortened. It's very thin, and they have time to get through the atmosphere to the bottom. So the two different explanations would depend on which reference frame you're in, but they do agree on the results of this experiment. Whichever reference frame you're in, you still say, aha, I now understand why almost all of those muons survive that trip when we would have thought they would decay. They survive based on one explanation or the other. And we do agree that the numbers on the detector, the counter, are in fact true by either explanation. So he'll go ahead and explain that now in the video.
Equations, because that's how it works, or is there some other law that dictates that the speed of light is always
I would kind of maybe take a couple of approaches to that. One is that there is another law that dictates that, and that's the Maxwell's equation we looked at last time on page 5, I think, in the book, that has the mu naught epsilon naught in it. And that, if Maxwell's equations are going to be true, then the speed of light has to be that same number. Another way to answer the question is what Goodstein just said at the end of the movie was, maybe there are other logically possible universes that are governed by different laws, but in our universe, the way these things have been worked out is that the speed of light is the same for all observers, and that does make everything explained. You can hypothesize it as a theory. It's one of Einstein's two postulates. You could say, if you were Einstein, what would the world be like if the laws of physics were the same for all observers and the speed of light were the same for all observers? And then work that out and see what happens. And then once you have a full-blown theory, you'd need to run out to Mother Nature and check and ask her and say, is this the way you work? And so you can kind of go at it both ways. I guess I'm answering your question both directions. If you hypothesize that the speed of light is the same for everybody, the consequences are that muons ought to make it to the bottom of the mountain and that the atomic clock on the airplane would be slower than the one that you left behind, et cetera, et cetera. And we do see these experimental effects. So hypothesize it, flesh out the theory, see what predictions it makes, and check them. And they bear out, and they bear out very, very precisely. So that's one answer. The other answer is, yeah, Maxwell's equations already demand that that be the case. Did I get at your question, Deb?
Yeah, he just made a comment in this lecture that said, if we assume this to be the case, it brings doubt. You know, he introduced a seed of doubt as he's saying that, and it just made me curious whether or not this was so because we postulated it, like Einstein said, or if it is that way because it is that way.
Yeah, I'd still reiterate both answers. It is that way because it is that way, but how did we find that out? We postulated it, and it made predictions that then bore out. Nobody was smart enough or clever enough or imaginative enough before that to come up with these two hypotheses and flesh out the theory that they then require. I mean, from those two hypotheses, clear back on page whatever it was, the beginning of the chapter, page 28, from those two postulates, all of this stuff follows. It's consequences. You don't have any choice once you make those two postulates. And so you make the two postulates not knowing whether they're really true of our universe or not, and then you flesh out and see what the consequences of this theory would have to be, and lo and behold, they match with what we see in real life. So then you say, oh, well, then that theory must be true. Those postulates, those hypotheses must have been correct about our universe. You could go at it either way, and I see your point. It's kind of interesting. I don't want to plant doubt in your mind as to whether we think this is really the way the universe works, but is it the only way that any universe could work, I think, is what Goodstein is getting at. And I don't know, and I don't think he does either. Maybe there's some other universe that's governed by different physical laws where relativity doesn't apply. But that's not our universe, and it's not the one that we imagined when we first started with the empty universe and then put in one object and then two objects. Just from that simple thing, you can pretty much deduce all of this stuff. So it seems to be fairly compelling in that sense. Okay, here's one on momentum. Let's see if I play all. I guess that's what I want to do. to the best of my recollection, anywhere in the book where it says that the mass increases with speed, or the mass is gamma times the rest mass. Instead, the modern treatments will do the relativistic momentum thing that you see on page 57, and they will then talk about relativistic energy that you see on page 60, and then they will tie it all together by page 63, the equivalence of mass and energy. Now, we really want to head to that. That's the most famous equation in the history of mankind, is E equals mc squared, that mass and energy are somehow equivalent. So we will talk about relativistic momentum being, you know, increased by this fast-moving thing with the gamma in there. And the energy also, you'll see that there as well. Equation 264 on page 63 says the energy is gamma times mc squared. So the idea is in there, but they generally tend not to isolate mass by itself and say mass equals gamma times the rest mass. Instead, they do it in terms of this energy and momentum, as our book does. So the treatment in the video is a little dated because it still says that m is equal to gamma times the rest mass. Reference frames, and they just go forever and ever and ever, then they'll never be able to compare the clocks, and each of them will always think the other one's clock is running slower, and it will be symmetric, but there will never be a paradox about one of them being younger than the other. The astronauts aged a few microseconds less when they went to the moon because they were going so fast, you know, 25,000 miles an hour, to get out of the Earth's, you know, what should I say, to get to the moon, they had to go pretty fast. And so they aged a little bit less. They should have not docked their pay a little bit. Other questions? Miles?
Probably lots, but I can't think of anything right now.
Marty Lynn? They can't hear you. You have to talk into the microphone.
The muon stuff.
Marty Lynn says she wants to talk more about the muon stuff. See, when you talk, Marty Lynn, it's like flatline on my audio thing here. So you got to be able to see your sound waves on them. Jacob, what would you like to say about the muon stuff?
I don't know.
Can you help Marty Lynn?
Probably not. I'm not sure.
Deb, you want to take a stab at making a comment about the muons?
Well, once we talked about it, and we talked about the shortening of the distance, that made a lot more sense. It cleared up the paradox that I was thinking about.
The paradox being that we would expect most of the muons to decay because they only live for 2 microseconds, and in that amount of time, as they're rushing down through the Earth's atmosphere, in 2 millionths of a second, they don't move very far, and they should, on average, at least, you know, a few might make it, but on average, most of them should decay and not make it to the Earth's surface. However, that's not what happens. Most of them make it, contrary to our expectation. So how do we explain this? Well, the secret is that they are moving very, very fast. So relativistic effects play a role. And we can explain it in either of two reference frames. We can say from the laboratory reference frame. Get some air into there. From the laboratory reference frame, we can say the muons are moving very, very fast, and therefore their clocks run slow. So what might be 2 millionths of a second to us, 2 microseconds to us, might only be, longer for them, or their clocks would tick so much slower that as those 2 microseconds tick by, they can go a long ways in a long time. From the other reference frame, from the muon's own reference frame, they could consider themselves to be at rest. The Earth is rushing up to meet them, they would see the atmosphere of the Earth as length contracted. So it wouldn't look like a normal 100-mile thick atmosphere. If they're going a huge percentage of the speed of light, 99% speed of light, then it would be greatly contracted. And even though their clocks aren't going slow, because we're now in their own reference frame, so their clocks go their normal speed to them, still 2 millionths of a second, it's okay because in 2 millionths of a second, you can get through a really, really, really thin atmosphere that's only a couple miles thick. So the length contraction of the atmosphere is the way they would explain it. We can get to the bottom of the atmosphere and hit the ground because the atmosphere is not very thick. Whereas on the ground, that inertial reference frame would say, well, it's the normal thickness, but their clocks are slowed down so they can still make it through. Does that help? They both agree on the numbers, but they might explain it slightly differently because they can both invoke these different aspects of the theory consequences.
So then we would also see the neurons slightly squished?
Yes. You mean squished in the direction of travel? Yeah. Yes, in fact, the Mechanical Universe videos were actually fairly careful to try and do that and illustrate that whenever anything was supposedly going a large fraction of the speed of light. They actually showed it squished. They show Henry's spaceship squished. They showed his train squished. They showed his baseball squished. And I noticed that because I've seen these many, many times. You may not have noticed it for a couple of reasons. It was your first time through these. But also the aspect ratio problems we've had viewing the screen. When those first spheres of light were expanding around, the very first experiment when Albert and Henry went by each other and the light spheres expanded around, we didn't have the aspect ratio on the viewing on the TV set right, at least not in our room. I don't know what you guys saw distance, but the circles weren't circles, they were ovals. We fixed it today so the circles would really be circles. But nonetheless, even if you get the right aspect ratio on your TV so the circles look like circles, they still drew the baseball as squished, and they still drew the spacecraft as squished in the direction of travel. Now, it's not squished perpendicular to the direction of travel in the Y or Z direction. It's only squished in the X direction. But they did show that. So, to answer your question, Deb, yes, we would see those muons coming toward us squished in that direction, so they'd appear shorter in the direction of their coming toward us. They'd appear to have their normal extent in perpendicular directions from their line of motion. But of course, the other point would be that muons are fundamental particles that have no size, and therefore, no, we couldn't, they don't look like billiard balls because they have no extent. They're not spatially large things like baseballs. They're point particles. So now the answer is no again. We wouldn't see them squished. But if they were baseballs, we would see them squished. If you look this stuff up on the web, you can find animations, movies that people make to try to show what things look like as you go at high speeds. And so that one diagram, where was that? I pointed to earlier about the shape of the rectangular things.
38.
Yeah, page 38. You can see movies of that on the web. I'll have to look for some and send you the URLs. And up on page 39 as well, people like to do computer-generated graphics that incorporate the equations of relativity and show you what things would look like at high rates of speed. And they look really, really weird because you can almost see behind you the way things get bent out of shape like that.
Okay. I have a question about... I've seen diagrams where...
The answer is, oh, wouldn't you know it, I'm going to get a reputation for this. The answer is yes and no. What you'll want to do is sneak a quick peek ahead to chapter 15, because that's where that stuff comes in. It's a true deal. Yes, space-time is warped and bent by gravitation and gravitating bodies, but that's not in the realm of special relativity. And maybe this is a good place to end this discussion. It might be about time to close up shop anyway. So unless you have other questions, we can squeeze them in too. But this might be a good point to make. Einstein arrived at his theory of special relativity, published it in 1905, his miracle year, and realized that it wasn't the theory to everything because it only addressed inertial reference frames. What he really wanted to say was, the laws of physics are the same for all observers, not merely all inertial observers. We talked about what an inertial reference frame is, and it's moving at a constant velocity, not accelerating, and you get special relativity. And he correctly deduced all that stuff, and we have experimental verification. It's good stuff. But he knew that it only addressed kind of a part of the universe, that is to say, things that are moving smoothly with respect to each other at constant velocities. Wouldn't it be nice to expand the theory and make it apply to non-inertial reference frames or accelerating reference frames? So he spent the next 10 years thinking about that. Gee, how can I apply relativity? How can I apply the idea that the laws of physics have to be the same for everybody, whether they're accelerating or not? And he eventually solved that puzzle and published his theory of general relativity in 1915 and 1916 over a series of papers during that two-year period. And that's chapter 15 at the end of our book, where we will talk about that in greater depth. Just one little teaser, though. It turned out that when he generalized relativity from special to general to take into account accelerated reference frames, he had what he called the happiest thought of his life, which was that, well, he worded it slightly differently, but it basically boils down to the idea that you can't detect your own weight if you're in free fall. Or another way to say that is, what he finally realized was, and we'll talk about this a lot more later, so don't worry if this doesn't make sense, it's just a teaser. What he finally realized was that acceleration is equal to, or equivalent to, or you can't tell the difference between acceleration and gravitation. So when he set out to create a theory of accelerated reference frames, what he actually ended up with is our, still to this day in 2007, current best theory of gravity. So general relativity, if you ask any physicist, what's our current best theory of gravitation, they'll say, well, it's a general theory of relativity. But he didn't start out to make a theory of gravity. He started out to make a theory of accelerated reference frames. He found out that you can't tell the difference between an acceleration and a gravitational field. So that's kind of fun. We do have a couple of minutes. Marty, can I borrow your book there? I should have brought my own. In our university physics book, Jacob, will you hand that to me? We use this book here, and it's really well done, but it even talks about relativity in the last couple of chapters in modern physics here. It covers some of the stuff we cover in this class, but it does it in kind of a nice approach, and so I should show you some of the things that Knight does. Let's do this on the Elmo. Those Ephraim students will have this textbook, and you can go look in chapter 36 on page 1185. And for those distant students, I may be able to find a graphic of this and send it to you. I don't know, but it's kind of a nice organizational way to think about all this energy and momentum and velocity stuff. He's kind of tried to put all this together in one little diagram. He calls it the velocity, energy, momentum triangle, and that's what it looks like. Also, in his treatment, he...
I can't see. There it goes.
We're baffled because we've been seeing it, and then Marty Lynn didn't do anything, and all of a sudden Deb said it was okay, and she still didn't do anything, and then Teresa said it went away. But isn't technology wonderful? Is everybody seeing it? Yeah. On the related page over here, I just want to also show you that this book doesn't use an M sub zero to represent the rest mass. They use M for that. The modern treatments use M for the rest mass, and then they multiply it by gamma if they need to have it, you know, the relativistic version of it. So you're not going to see an equation like in the video that says M equals M sub zero times gamma. They use M to mean M sub zero, and then they explicitly put on the gamma when they need it. That's the modern way. Anyway, this is a good treatment of relativity, too. So those of you who know and love this author from your other class, you may want to go ahead and read his treatment of relativity in chapter 36. which we will get to in our other class anyway. This semester, we will cover chapter 36 at the end of the semester. That's all I have to say. I'm basically considering us done with chapter 2, unless you have other further questions. I'm tentatively hoping that you'll be able to turn in some homework for chapter 2 in the next week, about next Wednesday or so. And I would also hope that next Tuesday, that's a long ways away from now, you'll come with lots of questions about chapter 3. I don't have a lot more videos to do like we've been doing this week. I have an occasional one for certain pieces, but most of the time from here on out we'll not be watching videos. It will be the discussion generated by your questions. So if you don't read and if you don't bring questions, class will be very short.
I have a question on the homework. Now, like what we need the facts to, is those the top learning problems and not the reading, the ones that say reading?
Correctamundo. Yes.
Okay.
In my extreme effort to not overload you, because I promised my students here in Ephraim that the workload in this class is not even in the ballpark of their other class, which is fairly heavy workload, I don't assign you to actually turn in all of the problems that I would have liked to. I do want you to read them because I find them beneficial, even to just get a passing familiarity with an idea, even if you don't work the problem. I think there's a little bit of value in reading them, so I assigned some of those on the second line. You do not need to work them or turn them in. The ones you'd fax in would just be the top line ones that you actually do.
Okay, thank you.
And I still encourage everybody, to what extent you can, to work with each other and not try to be the lone ranger on these homework problems. Okay, we're out of time, so send me an email, call me up, whatever you want, get some help. I have an answer book, and so whatever we need, we'll figure it out. And I'll see you next Tuesday.